Interview with Don Miloski, April 7th, 2010, in University Park, Florida, by Kenneth Durr. Terrific. Let's start with the backstory. And you mentioned that you're from Wisconsin.
Right.
I picked that up. Milwaukee native.
Yes.
And I noticed that you got both your undergrad and your law degree at Wisconsin.
Yes. Right?
Did you have any inkling that you were going to turn your law degree toward the securities industry when you were in college?
No, none whatsoever.
What was your focus, or what were you thinking about doing as a lawyer?
Well, I was interested in government, and I wasn't sure what that meant at the time. But I'll tell you why I was interested in government. And, the SEC was not on my radar screen at all at that time. This would have been in 1961. And in 1960, John Kennedy won the presidency. And I remember meeting him during the campaign, actually during the primary. Not meeting him personally in a sense, but just being along the rope line, so to speak, when he came to Madison. And then I found, I don't know, there was something to me that was very inspirational about that. And I know others have said the same thing, my friends. And I just thought the government was a place for me where I could do something. I didn't know much about it. In those days, things were a lot different in terms of the kinds of information. I mean, aside from having the internet, the availability of doing such quick research on almost any subject in the world, including what jobs are available and what organizations do and all that sort of thing. There just was a sort of a dearth compared to today of information, and it just was not available. I mean, you could call or write them and get information about them, but you got a pamphlet and you got an application form, and that was essentially it. But I was going into the Army, and what I thought was a 6-month period of time, I was in the ROTC, and as a matter of fact, I was finishing up ROTC while I was still in law school. And because you had to take classes and you had certain, drill things and stuff like that. But it did all come to a head at a point where there was the Berlin crisis, which started in 1962. And at that time, I was at Fort Carson, Colorado. I was due to get out in September of 1962, and I really was liking Colorado. I mean, I don't know if you've been, but it's a nice place, it's a beautiful area, etc. So I went to, I don't know how, I met somebody who worked at the SEC office in Denver. And he said, why don't you get a job here? I said, well, what do you do? He said, it's just stocks, it's bonds, it's frauds, it's stuff. And I had been admitted at that time. I was, just before I came, went into the Army, I was admitted to the bar in Wisconsin. I said, okay. And I interviewed with Don Stocking, Donald J. Stocking, who was the regional administrator at the time in Denver regional office. And they hired me. And at that time, I made, it was $6,600 a year. I have a recollection that we were paid bi-weekly then, in those days. And I was getting a check of like $200 a check. But it was fine. I mean, I was married, and my wife was working, and it was a nice life. But I then learned for the first time, once I got there, what the SEC actually did. I mean, I really didn't know. Kids today, of course, they'll tell you a lot more than you could imagine about what the SEC does, right, because they follow it, they research, they read about it, and so forth. And many of them clerk for the SEC, or they know people who've worked there. You know, it's all connected, right, one way or another.
Well, Denver was sort of the wild and woolly part, region, so to speak.
Yes.
Were they still doing uranium stocks and things like that back then in the 60s?
This was early 60s. It was coming to an end. It had been a big item in the 50s. And then I heard a lot of stories about the uranium frauds. It's an interesting office. It was an office that sort of got a reputation for being the office of the region administrators. Jerry Bolts was there as a lawyer. Bob Watson was there as a lawyer. Bob Davenport was there as a lawyer. And I was there. The four of us eventually became region administrators.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know.
Leadership?
Maybe. I think because obviously a combination of being around and being committed to the work, I guess. We were all... Bob was in enforcement. He was doing other things. He was doing reggae work when I got there.
Bob Davenport.
And we were enforcement guys. Jerry Bolts was the sort of the leader of enforcement, if there was such a thing. And Jerry had a wealth of experience in New York. He'd worked with Eddie Yeagerman. Now, have you come across mm-hmm. that name?
Yeah.
Okay,
then
you've probably heard a bunch of stories about Eddie Yeagerman. And Jerry came to Denver from... actually, he was in the D.C. office, but worked a lot in New York. He was originally from Ohio, and a very aggressive lawyer. He's now deceased. Jerry died a couple of years ago. Tremendous guy, a wonderful guy, and instilled a lot of enthusiasm and that sort of thing for the job. So I come in on the scene. It's kind of a funny story. There was a criminal case ongoing. I started November the 5th, 1962. There was a criminal case ongoing, and I think it involved a broker. I don't think it was a uranium deal. I think it was a stock deal of some sort that went bad. And they said, okay, Don, what I want you to do is, this is Jerry, I think, telling me, we want you to join the team, but basically you're going to bring witnesses to the courtroom. And these people have already been prepped. Well, you don't have to worry about any of that, because we know you don't know much about the case. Just go out, get a GSA car, go out, get them, escort them to the, show them where things are, and we'll show you where things are first, so you know where you're going. And our offices then, they were on 17th Street. We then moved to the federal complex. They since have moved a couple more times. So we were right adjacent to the federal courthouse. And, of course, Denver is also the home of the 10th Circuit. So we had a lot of law stuff going on. So I said, sure, I'd be happy to do this. This was, to get to know what's going on. And I always like courtroom stuff anyway. And so, go get this woman. She's an older lady, widow lady. She invested in the stock. She bought 100 shares or something. They want to show, the kinds of people that bought this stock. So I go out to her home, very polite, very nice, and I, she was waiting for me, knew what was happening and stuff. I took her to the witness room, and she was pretty calm, and I went into the audience to watch her testify, and because I was going to take her home. So she testified very well, and so I met her again in the witness room after she was finished, and I took her home. And I talked, told her I just got here and all kinds of stuff. And so I helped her to her door. I saw her to her door. I come back to my car. You know, it's funny how you remember stuff like this. And on the seat of the GSA car, in the middle of the seat, was a quarter. She left me a quarter for my service. I'll never forget that. And my first reaction was I was going to go in and give it back to her. And then I said, you know something? She probably liked doing this. Why would I? You know, I don't want to disappoint her in any way. And I just said, I'll keep the quarter. So, and by the way, the case resulted, the defendants were acquitted. Notwithstanding her good testimony. But the cases that I worked on there, first of all, it was a very aggressive office, old-time prosecutor kind of office. Don Stocking himself had been an assistant U.S. attorney in Montana. So he was a prosecutor. We had guys like Ed Ahern, who was an old guy, but he worked on quite a case. It was called Weaver's Beavers, which was a involved live beavers. You would buy an interest in them. They had different names, but I would call it as Weaver's Beavers. And in Utah, and they would keep the beavers, pair them up, and have kits or whatever they're called, and then eventually they would sell the beaver fur, and you would have, that's how you would make money. So this was an investment contract and situation, and it was a big, big case. It was already filed. As a matter of fact, it went up to the 10th Circuit, and we did win that case because it was, much like the Orange Grove case, which preceded that here in Florida, actually. The Supreme Court held that it had all the elements of an investment contract. And it was pretty obvious that, you know, it did. But it was very popular. People out west are more, they have a different kind of investment philosophy. I mean, they really like the speculation there, not just in buying a stock, which I think, but, you know, other kinds of scams and stuff.
So tangible things.
We had plenty of work. There was no question about that.
Was the beaver thing going on when you got there?
It was going on when I got there. Okay. Yeah. And I helped Ed with the case. So I had those two little things, but then the big thing came along in April of 1963. And that was the why did it go out of my mind? I'll get the name for you in a moment. It was a guy who ran savings and loans in Colorado Springs. And he advertised a lot that he would pay on bonds, that there were debentures and there were like savings and loan. Joe W. Newcomer. And what it evolved into was a Ponzi scheme, just classic. And it involved about $5 million, which in those days was a lot of money. A lot of military people who retired in that area invested. And so I was on that case. I didn't handle it myself. We had an assistant regional administrator, Joe Christ. Joe is a very astute, very sort of brainy kind of guy. And Joe was leading the case. And eventually we brought a suit. We got a receiver appointed. And we got injunctions. And there was also a criminal case. So this was my introduction to the whole panoply. We didn't have an administrative proceeding, but we had everything else.
Did you work with state prosecutors?
We worked with federal prosecutors. I'm not sure the state was involved. I think I even testified before a state committee about these savings and loans because they were all around Colorado, and they were very loosely regulated, and they wanted to know, you know, what happened here. And they wouldn't be examined at all. No, there was no examining authority on the state level. That's what boiling it down. And so this thing was able to mushroom the way it did. And one little story there, and I got to know the receiver, so I got to know the function of a receiver, because I would go to various hearings and things of this sort. And he was a very astute guy. And he gathered enough assets to pay people 10 cents on the dollar of their losses. That was it. There's not much left. But I went around to investors because we still had a pending case ongoing. We had gotten a preliminary injunction, but we had a full permanent case to go. So I went around and got affidavits from investors. And I went to Colorado Springs, and a lot of people were very cooperative. They were very helpful. And I went to one guy, lived in a, it was not a hovel or anything, but he lived in like a trailer park kind of area. And so I knocked on the door, I told him who I was. I was a lawyer with the SEC, Joe W. Newcomer, etc. Yeah, come on in, I'll tell you what happened. And I said, I'd come back with an affidavit based on what you're telling me. Fine, no problem. So I come back, and with an affidavit. It was all very straightforward stuff. There was no... Actually, you could just probably had a standard affidavit for everybody. They saw something on TV or heard it on the radio. High interest was being paid, and they decided they wanted to invest. That boiling
thing. So you want to get them to sign that, and you use that later.
So I knock on the door, and he comes to the door, and it was like a different person. Very upset. He says, Now, when the first time I met him, he was talking about, this is another little thing out in Colorado in the West, he was talking about the original Constitution, not even the amendments. I was listening to him, very, very nice. He says, yeah, I have a Constitution. He's got a flag, he's got a this and a that. And I said, oh, that's... He says, yeah, the Constitution. So he showed me something. And it was the Constitution without the amendments. I said, where are the amendments? Well, you run into people out west like this, you know. I think you run into them today, too. Mm-hmm. It's kind of what we... But this, so I went back, and all of a sudden, I mean, he opened the door, and he saw who I was, and he just was very angry. He didn't want to do anything. He didn't... Very, very angry. And I don't want to sign any goddamn affidavits. I don't care about nothing. This was about 11 o'clock in the morning. I go, so I was very disappointed. And I had other investors to, you know, but I was, you know, why did this guy, I didn't say anything. I didn't, you know, just his whole attitude was totally negative. Back to the office, and he said, yeah, did you hear what happened? I said, no. What happened? He said, Kennedy's shot. So this was November 22nd. Really? What, you know, and of course everybody was in a state of, you know, not knowing what was going on. And that was on a Friday. Pretty sure it was a Friday. And I sort of connect the two events. You know, it's one of those things. Because I've had other people that have turned me down, I'm sure, to cooperate. But that was a very... in terms of memory, that was something that was very startling to me. Then, after all of that, so then I started to get a lot of oil and gas cases and mining cases. Now, we had in our office a mining engineer. Now, this is a little history. I'm not sure people know a whole lot about, but Charlie Higdon, H-I-G-D-O-N, was a mining engineer. Now, Charlie was a big, not big, he was tall, but he was a gruff, big, huge mustache. And he would talk like that. Don, we have to go out to the mine today. I said, okay. So he would take me out to the mines. We had a case called Lamartine Mines, which was an old famous mine in Colorado back in the 1890s. And these promoters had gotten another public company and then changed the name to Lamartine.
Okay.
So we went to the mine, and he went into this mine. He says, well, he says, it's a little dangerous. He said, because these places are just empty. These have been sitting here for decades, these mines, without any, any activity. And so he went in, and I sort of followed a little bit. He was taking samples, and then he went to an assay office and had it assayed. So it was like that kind of thing with Charlie. And of course, we used him as a witness through either affidavit. We had a case against Lamartine. We had other cases. So that was on the mining side. On the oil and gas side, which is quite big in the West, as you might imagine, we had Tell T. White. Have you come up to that name?
I haven't heard that.
Okay, Tell T. White. Who's Tell T. White? Well, he also worked for the SEC. He was his oil and gas engineer in Washington. His home, however, was in Pocahontas, Arkansas, which is in the northeast part of the state. So frequently, when I would call him, he would be in Pocahontas. He'd be home and doing his studies or whatever he did for cases. But he would also look at a lot of filings, oil and gas filings as well. So we did cases. So I did cases with Tell. Both these guys are deceased now, I'm sure. But they were, between the two of them, there were no others like them in the commission in the 50s and the 60s. And I'm sure it extended after I was gone into the 70s.
So this is not just disclosure. These guys are going out and ascertaining whether this stuff's any good or not.
Correct. They investigated with the lawyers. And we used to drive. I used to get GSA cars and drive out to oil wells with Tell. I mean, today you would use a four-wheel drive vehicle, a SUV. Those days you had a Studebaker or something. I don't know what the heck we had. And we would go out to these oil wells to see if they were in fact, operating.
So would you bring cases if you found something?
Sure. We brought a lot of cases. We had an iron ore mine case where this guy took about $300,000 from Iowa investors and deposited the checks. I don't know if I can recall the name right now, but deposited the checks at a Las Vegas casino. I mean, of all things, when I got the checks, this is one thing I really got good at, how to go to banks, and I did it myself. In those days, you can imagine what you had. There was a machine of some sort, and then it was on a,
microfiche.
Microfiche.
Uh-huh.
And I would go through microfiche and then print. I would do all the work. Today, you just give a subpoena and it's a little different. And I would go through all these checks front and back and pick out those that. So I saw all the deposits and I looked at the back and it was all, I forget, Sands Hotel and stuff like this. Well, long and short of it is we got him prosecuted in Iowa, the prosecutor in federal court was Donald. He became a federal district court judge at some point. I can't recall his last name. I'm sorry.
Was there much discussion about what Washington thought of all this, what the relationships were with D.C.? I mean, given that this is such an unusual place.
To my knowledge, no.
Okay.
I'm sure there were there would be the annual administrative regional, the RA conference. There were other conferences later on in my career, and they're still going on, the enforcement conference and the market reg conference and things like that. But in those days, there was only one conference. And I'm sure they were discussing cases. I wasn't there. I went there for one in I think this 1967, when I was contemplating coming back here. Don said, why don't you come and you can meet some of the people from the New York office, and he was gracious enough to do that, and I went back. Bob Davenport and I worked on the Edward Dosa case, which was a big prosecution. He had an audience with the Pope. You know, he was one of these, played up the religious angle, but he was also a fraudster. I have got a funny story about that case. We had, I didn't work as much in Wyoming and Utah, but Nebraska was sort of my stamping ground. Did a lot of injunctive actions. We didn't have as many administrative cases. We didn't have as many brokers. There were some. I had a few cases like that, but most of them were injunctive actions or criminal cases. A lot of criminal cases. A lot of our cases went criminal for pretty good reasons. I mean, they're pretty extreme conduct. One case involved three defendants. And again, the bank records really told the whole story. But the deal was as follows. This was in Nebraska. Two guys would go around. One guy would go around, and he would have a bird dog. What we used to call them bird dogs. Would take him around, a local guy. And he would get oil and gas leases in New Mexico. He would pay 50 cents an acre. I think you can still get them for 50 cents an acre, if I'm not mistaken. 50 cents an acre is vacant land, because they pretty much know what's has oil and what doesn't. They would charge these folks $5 an acre, and with a big pitch about, we're going to come back in about 6 months, and we're going to pay you anywhere from $10 to $15 an acre. We have to do this because we have to use your name to actually do the leasing. If they did our name, it was Inland Oil. If we used our name, everybody knows our name, we'd have to pay a lot more for these leases. We have to pay like $5, or we have to pay $10 or so. You have to pay only $5. Well, obviously getting the acreage for 50 cents and then charging $5, they were making a lot of money. But that wasn't the end of it. There was a guy, an old guy at that time, who would go around to see all these folks. We had dentists, we had farmers, you know. I was in North Platte, Nebraska, which was sort of the hub of where all this activity was going on. And the old guy would come around to see these folks, and he had a card. And the card said, Standard Oil of Venezuela. And he said, I want to pay you, and he used different prices, but significantly more than $5. I want to pay you, this was like 30 days or a month or two after they bought. We're going to pay you $10 an acre. Okay? And all these people got really excited. And his last name was Mitchell. And what he would do is he would go to see all these people, and Standard Oil, you know, that's what people were hearing. And it sort of meshed with the other story that this was valuable. And but everybody, and I interviewed everybody, there's a large number of people, maybe 30 or 40 of them, would do it. Because they had committed themselves with Inland Oil, with that group. They were honest people, you know, they weren't going to sell their lease. So they said, well, thank you very much, but we're not going to sell. We're going to sell with Inland Oil. We've got an agreement with them. So obviously the next step was nothing happened. the Inland Oil people never came by again, and people, so they had leases that they paid $5 an acre for. And they started to complain initially to the state securities commissioner. But these guys were running around from Kansas to Nebraska to New Mexico, etc. So they called us in, and I was assigned the case. And didn't go injunctive, just went straight criminal. And that's how the office got to know me. It's the U.S. Attorney's Office in Omaha, okay, which handled... And the case was actually brought in Lincoln, Nebraska, where there was also a federal court. They were all convicted on all counts. And I got to do, not only prepared the indictment, the actual indictment that was used, I testified before the grand jury about the case. I was probably the only one that did. Maybe some of the investors. I prepared the witnesses for trial. I wrote the instructions for the judge because there were some security. I decided not to go securities on this one, just mail fraud, because it's too complicated. You know, it's just go mail fraud. It's a fraud. People understand that. And so they were all convicted, and which I think was my first case of where a criminal case where they were convicted. And at the sentencing, so the three guys, there's the bird dog, his name was Christ. He was about 68. The bad guy from Inland Oil, he was in his late 60s also. And the guy that was going around from Venezuela, he was in his 70s. So I was there for the sentencing. And the lawyers were making a big pitch, Your Honor, these guys are, look how old they are. They shouldn't go to jail. You know, they've learned their lesson. As a matter of fact, the guy that was going around from Venezuela, there's a 10th Circuit case. The reason I found out, I got an idea of how this whole scheme worked, was from the 10th Circuit case, which was identical to this thing. Oh, okay. So, I mean, the same thing. And he was convicted and went to jail in that one. So, the judge said, well, yes, they're in their late 60s and one is in his early 70s. But you know something? And I'm looking at the judge, and I got to know the judge. You know, in the smaller communities, you get to know them. You know something? I'm a little on the older side. This is the judge talking now. On the older side myself. And I found out at that time he was in his early 70s. He says, you know, you go to jail, and there's a dentist there, they fix your teeth, you get three meals. The beds aren't that bad, they're comfortable. You know, you can, it's not that bad, it's not as bad as you might think. So he then sentenced the bad guy to 5 years in jail, and the other two, three each. And I always remember that kind of thing, you know, they were appealing about these guys were so old, and here the judge himself was their age, yeah, you know. Yeah.
Didn't work out that way.
The other criminal case that we had was Edward J. Dosick. I mentioned that before, mm-hmm. And Bob and I worked on it. He was a mean son of a gun. He sold stock in a company and just looted the company, basically. And Bob and I, we got an injunction in that one because it was a straightforward stock case, but we also went criminal on it. He had the best seats at the Nebraska football games. He was well known in the whole state. He had the audience with the Pope.
So what was he doing exactly?
He was raising money in the company selling stock. I'm not even sure it was registered, but he was, you know, sort of like a private placement kind of deal.
Okay.
And but he had a large number of people. He probably had about several hundred of them. And that case we also brought in Lincoln, Nebraska. And we liked the juries there. You know, you always want to get the juries. And they were very, in those days, you could, the grand juries were really they were people that were very law and order type, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Blue ribbon kinds of juries. A lot of places you don't get that, especially in the large urban areas. So we brought the case there, and it should have been brought there because that's where he lived and stuff. And so he was fighting us. The one story that I had there, and I don't want to bore you too much with these goofy little stories, but in his defense, a name came up about somebody who liked him and was satisfied with the investment. So we were going over this that night. It was about 7, 8 o'clock at night, maybe later. So the assistant U.S. attorney, he actually was trying the case with the U.S. attorney at the time. But Blumenthal was his name. But he said, "Don, how are we going to... I'd like to bring this guy in as rebuttal witness." So I said, "Well, where the hell does this guy live?" "Well, he lives out in... he lives out near Madrid." Now, in this country, if you have a name like Madrid, they'll pronounce it differently.
Right.
There's cities all over that have names like that. Houston Street is really Houston.
Right.
Okay, as an example. Okay, Madrid. Okay, so I said, "Well, let me call this guy." So now we're talking 65, 66, maybe 66. Well, he's not listed. So I call the operator. Chatty lady. She says, "Oh, yeah, I know. He doesn't have a phone. You have to get the neighbor people to he's about 5 miles away, to go and get him and bring him to the phone." These were all in ranching and farming and stuff. Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, can you connect me to the neighbor people?" "Sure." Okay, so they connect me. So I talked to him. I said, "Well, you know," I asked him, "what kind of phone do you have there? It sounds pretty..." He says, "Well, we have one of the old crank phones." Not even a dial. I said, "Well, can you..." I'm trying to get a hold of him. I'm calling from the U.S. Attorney's office. This is about 9 o'clock at night. He says, "Sure. It'll take about a half hour." I said, "Okay. Here's the number. Call me back." Call back. And I said, "Well, we need you. Ed Dosik testified about you, said some things about you." He said, "Oh, that son of a bitch. What do you want me to do?" I said, "Well, we need you here in the office tomorrow morning. Now, if you know Nebraska, it's a pretty big state. Lincoln on one end and Madrid on the other." I said, "Here's what we'll do. I'll call Frontier Airlines, and I'll have a place for you on the plane. It'll be around 6 o'clock in the morning. Can you do it?" "Sure." I said, "Okay." So I called Frontier. We got him a seat on the plane, and of course, went back to go home. About 8:30 the next morning, we're getting ready, and a guy walks in. In bib overalls, kind of boots with stuff all over them, So he says, well, I'm here. I said, you're here. You did come. He says, yeah, well, I said I would. He said, yeah, you sure did. So we then prepped him a few minutes and we put him on the stand. He was terrific. And I said, you know, thank you for coming. I really appreciate that. So in those days, you had people, certainly out in that part of the world, that part of the country, people who believed in governments enough that they get a phone call out of the blue late at night and to go the next morning very, very early to get on a plane to fly to Lincoln. I mean, you know, the whole idea, if we did it with anybody in New York, for example, they'd tell me where it is. So, and of course, he was convicted. And he was a good witness because he had just completely rebutted everything this guy was saying.
Well, that's a good transition to the next step in your career, because it must have been a huge change to go from the type of situation you're talking about to New York. Yeah. In some respects, it would seem like you're kind of being called up to the majors. I mean, obviously, New York is where the biggest action is. Was that the case? Was that kind of how it worked?
I think you hit it right on the head. I think you did. And in a sense, I didn't even realize it, but that's the way it was. We had seen in Denver, Malin Frankhauser would come out. He was with the criminal group. In the home office, Irv Pollack would come out because Irv was still very active, you know, as a staff guy. Mm-hmm. So I got to meet them, and what evolved from that is that Malin became the region administrator in the New York office in 1967. And the office needed a lot of help. I mean, it needed a makeover. They weren't braining cases. They weren't. A lot of the young lawyers weren't that inspired. They were staying a year. I mean, for anybody to stay even 2 years was a major thing. And so they were looking for stability. And Malin brought in some people. In addition to myself, I became a branch chief. We had. Just saw his name again. I can get it for you if you want it. Dave, he was also from Wisconsin. David worked in the enforcement in Washington. Dave Bliss was the associate. And working for me was Marvin Pickholtz. I don't know if that name, if you run across Marvin. He's the one that actually founded the SECA.
Hmm.
You know, the Association for SEC Alumni, which has gotten kind of a big deal. And so we had kind of, it was the wild and woolly of the East, not of the West, but of the East. And I had a lot of catching up to do.
What do you mean?
Well, I think there weren't oil and gas cases, you know, there weren't these little goofy frauds and stuff like that. What we had basically were, you know, a lot of manipulation kinds of cases, a lot of fraud cases, new issue cases where companies, even though they were either Reg A or registered, they tend to disappear early on, and there were a lot of complaints and that kind of thing. So if you're looking at the time frame, I really started in January of 1968. We were still in the transportation building. Which was it's the building just south of the Woolworth building. And then what a dump that was. The landlord obviously knew we were moving out, and there was paint peeling off. And it was awful. And Eddie Yeagerman, he was a bit of a sleazeball, and Eddie would sleep there. So he would collect the per diem. By the way, the per diem used to be, when I was in Denver, it used to be $16 a day. And you didn't have to account for it. You know, if you had something extraordinary, yes, and you were authorized to spend it, mm-hmm. but you had a booklet So you could write out your tickets for your transportation, you know, usually air. Or when you got to your destination, and we were a big region, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, not Kansas, but Nebraska, the Dakotas, Wyoming. That was our region, pretty big. Maybe the biggest by far, I think, in terms of land area. So you have $16 to work with. I usually came back with a buck or two I made. And other guys sort of got the feel for it. But I get back east, and of course things are much different. And starting, I would say, in 1969, it just seems to be a change. Mahon brought in a lot more new lawyers. Lawyers who, when I got there, let me back up. When I got there, there was Roberta Carmel, was the assistant regional administrator. Dennis Block. I know you know Dennis.
No.
Well, Dennis is pretty well known in the securities field in New York. Was a branch chief. I was a branch chief. And the Mahon, of course, was the region administrator. Bill Moran, I don't know if you've heard of Bill's name. That's a whole couple of hours right there with Bill. Arthur Goldman was the associate in charge of enforcement. Dick Bandler. What became what we call the 10th floor. When we made the move over to 26 Federal Plaza, the 11th floor was basically the enforcement, the examiners, Reg A, and the, you know, head of the RA's office and the chief trial counsel. And the 10th floor was 40 acts and bankruptcy. At that time, bankruptcy was a big deal. Chapter 10.
Why?
Because a lot of companies, the laws have since changed and evolved, but a lot of companies would go into bankruptcy reorganization under Chapter 11. They essentially stayed in control. And pretty much as they would do today. You stay in control, you continue to function, but you're in bankruptcy. So you have the protections.
Right.
10, not every company did we want to go into 10, but basically if it was a significant company with large numbers of shareholders, we would want a clean house. We'd look at the situation carefully, and then we'd want to have an independent bankruptcy receiver under Chapter 10. These were big, hard-fought things.
Okay.
And it was a big piece of the commission's business back then. It later faded away. And also there was the Trust Indenture Act, which was sort of related to that, because in offerings, because you had to create a trust indenture, and there was usually some problem with that in reorg. But there was also there was another act that we enforced. Oh, the Public Utility Holding Company Act.
Oh, sure.
PUCA. Mm-hmm. So they had some involvement with PUCA in the 10th floor. But it was mostly examiners, Chapter 10, and the 40 Act, examiners to do the 40 Act, you know, the mutual fund investment advisor exams.
So which floor were you on?
I was on 11. I was, as I said, I became, within a year, in 1969, I became an assistant regional administrator. And then in a few years, Arthur left. See, Bill became the associate for enforcement. Bill Moran And Kevin Duffy came. You know Kevin?
No.
Oh, you don't know Kevin. Okay. Malin left to go to the stock exchange in the summer of 1972. So I'd just been there for 4 years. Maybe it'd be useful to give a little... before Malin was Lou Young. Lou Young was a Kennedy appointment. And he was a very, you know, he wore bow ties. He was sort of a very kind of, looked like a Wall Street banker or something. I mean, and he was sort of a bottleneck and a very prissy kind of guy. Hmm. But there were, I think that's one of the reasons the office fell in decline, because they just weren't generating the volume of cases. And they started to, in the 50s, was a regional administrator, the name of which will come to me.
Paul Wendell.
Paul Wendell.
Yeah.
Paul Wendell's was part of the knock down the door kind of thing. And Ed Yeagerman and his sidekick, the name will come to me. His sidekick was an All-American tackle at Yale.
Callahan?
Tim Callahan. Would go to one of these boiler rooms. They'd literally knock the door down.
Right.
And they would separate the guys. You know, openers here, closers there, dynamiters here. You know, whatever the names are, whatever roles they had in doing a boiler room. And these guys would sort of separate out.
Right.
And then they would give them subpoenas, and they would bust these guys.
Right.
That was sort of the wild, woolly time, the 50s, because they even had a boiler room in our building, in the transportation. They went to the 10 floors down, they found this place.
So that had changed substantially then by the time you got in there.
Exactly.
Things were sleepier.
It was applying a very, very tough approach between Yeagerman, who no one controlled. If anybody did, it was Irv. But he was out of control. I mean, there are a lot of stories about him. He would file cases without getting authority from the SEC, for example. Mm. And there's a notorious case like that. In Iowa, he did that. He went up to Canada and accused he would be the equivalent of the premier of one of the provinces of being in on some kind of scheme and would upset the whole governmental, you know. I mean, he did some wild stuff.
Typical loose cannon.
Very loose. And he also went, there were three guys that fled to Brazil in the 50s because they were doing scams and stuff. He would bring them back, at least brought back one of them. And would go down to Brazil. He wrote himself like that. I mentioned to you, you'd write your own ticket, so to speak.
Yeah.
He did that. No one authorized it. Found the guy, brought him back. Very unusual guy. He later, this really gets into a lot of stuff now. He later became the managing director of Charles Plum, a New York broker-dealer. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but when we brought a case against Charles Plum, the New York Stock Exchange, let's see, I just want to make sure I'm not making this too complicated by getting it too... Let me go back to the organization for a moment. After Lou Young, Malin leaves to go to the stock exchange in 1969. Kevin is appointed in July of 1969. I don't know why this date
And is he doing this building up thing too? Is he sort of looking to re-energize?
That's not his style. Kevin had been an assistant U.S. attorney. He had been into Republican politics to some extent, not greatly, but to some extent. And the changeover to, you know, we're talking about the years, if you just think about the years, 69, Nixon takes over, Malin leaves to go to the stock exchange. See, his appointment was done under...
Johnson.
Under Johnson, but under the chairman was...
Hamer Budge?
Cook. Hamer came earlier.
Okay, Cook?
Not Cook. Cook was also earlier.
Okay.
Cook came later.
Right, Casey, Bill Casey.
Bill Casey came later.
Okay.
Casey was there in 72. Matter of fact, in my cards here, I wrote some things about that. A lot of what we... Okay, so if we just go Lou Young, Malin, Kevin. Mm-hmm. Kevin stays until... Kevin is July of 1969... until 1972. He becomes a federal judge in the Southern District.
Okay.
Before that happens, he argues before the Second Circuit, the Plum, Charlie Plum case. I guess I should get into this.
That's Plum?
Plum, P-L-O-H-M.
Okay.
N, Plum, Charlie Plum. Charlie Plum was well known on Wall Street at the time for doing a lot of hot issues and being fairly successful. They got in trouble with the New York Stock Exchange because they did not... It involved one of the rules dealing with... sequestering securities and having adequate securities to meet customer demands and have the security for those demands. And the stock exchange suspended them, knowing that they could get back into compliance. They wanted to get rid of Plum. I don't know if I should say this, but what the hell, this is a lot of years.
It's been a while.
They wanted to get rid of Plum for different reasons. And they did. So we were now stuck with Plum. We brought an injunctive action. Kevin was the regional administrator. I was on the case. It was my case. Along with... some other lawyers, and we filed the case representing Plum. I'm trying to think, the boxing promoter. Do you know boxing promoters?
Not too well, no.
There's a very famous boxing promoter, I'll have to get the name, today,
okay,
who worked for a very well-known firm. I should have gotten the names.
That's okay, I can look it up.
And he was a very astute lawyer. So the case was filed with Judge McMahon. Judge McMahon, in those days, you had irascible judges. I mean, everybody was frightened of them. Kevin knew him actually pretty well. I think he clerked for him at one time. So we filed the case. We asked for appointment of a receiver, which was, this is pre-SIPC now. And so here we go. And we charge them with violating this rule. And we want a receiver to basically liquidate the firm. Their lawyer, and the name will come to me, on a Friday afternoon. Oh, we went to Chambers, Judge McMahon's Chambers, with Eddie Yeagerman, who was not Charlie Plum, but Eddie. They were hopeful that Eddie, being a former SEC guy, and he would be known by maybe some of the judges and stuff, and then with this lawyer. And the judge had sitting in his waiting room the receiver and the lawyer for the receiver. And Plone's lawyer objected vociferously. He wanted a hearing. And the judge was crazed. I mean, I was there. I think Marvin Pickholz and I went over. He just went bananas. As only Judge McMahon can do. He said, okay, I'm going to order on Monday, I'm going to order the appointment of the receiver and the receiver's lawyer. Either that day, which would have been a Friday, or the next day, but it was a Friday, late afternoon. He goes in, the lawyer, to the clerk's office of the Second Circuit. And gets a Rule 27 order. Now, what's a Rule 27 order? Rule 27 is a rule under the circuit that says if the judges are not otherwise available to issue an order, on a temporary basis, the clerk can issue an order. That's what he did. McMahon was, I mean, it was something. We then had a hearing the next week, and he appointed the receiver and the lawyer for the receiver. Goes up to the circuit, Rule 27, the whole schmear. And Kevin argues the case before the circuit. Because Kevin was fairly well known by the judges. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I'm not sure Kevin did a great job of arguing the case or not. But Dave Ferber would normally argue those cases. Do you know who Dave Ferber is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and by the way, I met Dave Ferber out in Denver. I went to Ferber would have a party at every regional administrator's conference, a party at his home. Brilliant man, but he did all of the appellate work for the commission. Very precise, prissy kind of guy. I got to know him pretty well, and he sort of liked me.
So in this case, you've got Kevin Duffy.
So instead of David Ferber, we thought, well, let's go for the home court advantage and put Kevin up there. Well, the circuit ruled for us. I mean, there wasn't really much they could have done otherwise. And we got our receiver, and Plone was liquidated. As a little footnote, at Merrill Lynch, Plone's son, Charlie Plone Jr., I guess, or Charlie Plone II, was worked there and worked in a very complicated, interesting area, a lot of responsibility. And I got to, we talked a little bit about the case.
Yeah.
Merrill Lynch is a great place. It was a great place. And so you'd find a lot of talent there and so forth.
But, well, you've been talking about bankruptcies, liquidations, and you mentioned SIPC. And that would have come in during the time, your early period in New York City.
I was, of anybody, I could take out a firm in hours with a receiver. We had a lot of little firms that would come And as it turned out, we're getting some bigger firms that either were converting to computer, converting, and they lost control. I can't give you the names right now, but later on, I'll give you the big one. I had the paperwork done. I had an affidavit. Usually we could file it, and I would call the judge's chambers and ask frequently these things happen at the worst times. Like on a Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Friday afternoons are really busy. Okay. And I would march over there, and usually I'd have the consent. I'd sort of instruct the defendants and their lawyers what role they had to play. And we'd get a receiver appointed.
Tell me about the role that you're instructing them to play.
Well, several things. They would have public customers or have obligations to other broker-dealers, which could prove problematic if they stopped doing business. So the first thing I instructed them to do is to make sure the books and records were not moved from the office, that they were kept there. I would work with the receiver also to along those lines, so that we had a sort of an orderly transition. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have, some funny business going on. Usually we tried to get people to stay there until the receiver, not the sales or trading people, because they were out of business, but certainly the back office people and some of the management to stay there at least for a week or something. So that was the second thing we tried to do, so that they would show the receiver, where the books are, and if he had questions, they would be in the position to answer the questions. Thirdly, there would be outstanding obligations of one sort or another, and that would raise a lot of questions as to what they could or could not do. We try to stay away from that, but sometimes you couldn't help but get involved in those kinds of things.
Prioritizing the obligation.
We had cases where, now that I haven't thought of this in a long time, but we had cases where we had one broker in Long Island that tried to corner the market in a Amex stock. They had so much stock, it was incredible, and of course they drove the price up, but they couldn't dispose of it. So as an asset, it looks like it was a very valuable asset, but they came into us, and they went into receivership. They came into us with the view that we had to help them somehow with this position. I'm not sure we helped them, but we tried to work it out as best as we could, as best as we could figure it out. We had probably had more than one case like that.
So you're helping or sort of counseling on how they can maybe get rid of this stock without destroying the market.
Right. I was probably going a little farther than I should have. But, the alternative was not particularly good either.
Yeah, right.
So once we got, and the receivers sometimes didn't know what to do. I mean, these were pals of the judges, basically. And some of them did not have lawyers at the outset. Some of them did. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just too costly. And I would... One of the things I used to do was call lawyers and see if they would volunteer to pitch in, outside lawyers. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know if you can get paid on this thing, but, guys that I knew, and a few did, and the judges knew lawyers that they could, point on this one, maybe right. There's a bigger thing right. later on. And stuff like that.
So these reorganizations are an early specialty of yours, apparently, the bankruptcies and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
What other kinds of areas of expertise were you developing in New York?
Well, we had fraud cases. We had inside information cases. Keep in mind that Texas Gulf Sulphur in the 60s was still... As a matter of fact, I worked on the Texas Gulf Sulphur case, as did a lot of people. Not in the initial stages, but we were looking for investors. We were looking for... There was a fund to compensate people. And so we were solicited, you know, we were asked to do this by the Home Office. Matter of fact, Dave Ferber, that's one of the few cases, because this was a huge advancement in the world of SEC, Texas Gulf.
Right.
This is the first insider trading case. There was a few cases leading up to it, a little history, but nothing like this. You're familiar with
the
Texas mm-hmm. Gulf case. And it was strongly litigated. I mean, it was tough stuff, and we prevailed on the Second Circuit. I don't think it ever went to the Supreme Court. I don't think there's a Supreme Court case on Texas Gulf. But in any event, so those kinds of, we had cases, a lot of the lawyers involved were crooked. There was one firm, Felchu and Frank. I don't know, there's a woman who performs on Broadway for many years. Her name is Felchu. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of her?
I think I have, yeah.
Tova Felchu.
Yeah.
She's the daughter of and he was also a very distinguished looking guy. When I got there, there was a case against Marty Frank, who was his law partner. And I saw Felchu, and I said, because most of my cases had been settled, I said, you guys, and they had prevailed. What happened is the judge had not made findings of fact on a preliminary injunction. And the Second Circuit said that you can't do that and reversed the decision of the district court judge. So the case was open for further litigation. So I said to Sydney, I said, Sydney, would you, I think I called him Mr. Felchu. I was very respectful. I said, would you be interested in talking about a consent? Well, I would never in the million, you know, the guy went off. So I said, well, you know, you may want to do this. It's going to be, you know, we're going to have to pursue this. Well, they did consent. And without admitting or denying. And, but Marty was a crook. Marty, Felchu was a crook. And we saw him all the time in our offices representing people. But Marty Frank he did a lot of enforcement work. He would call up and say, Don, when he had a witness, 5 minutes. I said, okay, Marty, what does 5 minutes mean? It means that he's going to bring the witness in, he's going to take the fifth. And of course, we're not going to, you know, that's it. He organized a lot of these. He worked with the issuers in a number of fraudulent offerings. I mean, just rank stuff.
So would he be the kind of guy who'd have a reputation that people who were going to do this sort of thing would call him?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So that's why you would run into him all the time.
Felchu went to jail, and he went to jail for that. Marty Frank did. But Felchu went to jail because he donated stock to a synagogue and backdated it to get the value. You know, it was worth a lot more. Mm-hmm. He backdated by 18 months or something. And so it was a tax fraud. He went to jail. We had others. We had guys that were running, who went to Israel, fleeing the country. These were lawyers, I can't give you the names right now, but lawyers that practiced before us on a frequent basis that did a lot of crooked stuff. They were, I mean, just pretty, when you think about it, pretty awful. I mean, these guys, but we knew it. They knew that we knew it, and, you know, it was much more interesting.
So you're talking about a lot of criminal stuff here, I guess, right?
Yes.
Was that mostly what you, the kinds of things you were involved in, given your experience?
First of all, in the Southern District of New York, there is the Securities Fraud Unit. Still to this day, Securities Fraud, Commodity Fraud Unit. The director of the I think this is right, the director of Enforcement Division came out of that unit, or the Eastern District, I forget which one. But that was well known, Steve Hammerman, all these guys, Bob Morvillo, all these guys, the superstars of the criminal, of the prosecutors, was there. When I came back, I heard about the fraud unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay.
And people spoke of it in awe. I mean, they were so effective. They had a lot of our investigators over there helping them.
Now, at some point, Hammerman would have come in to run the New York regional, right?
Exactly. Steve came in 1979.
Okay.
This is after Bill Moran left. Bill became the regional administrator after Kevin.
Okay.
And was there for about 7 years, which sort of takes me to the New York City case. Actually, takes me to a lot of cases, but...
municipal bonds?
Right. And, oh, by the way, I should back up a little bit. What we did in New York on the broker-dealer cases, we probably had well over half of all the cases that involved failing broker-dealers. Congress then passed SIPA. And, you know, the whole idea of a SIPA trustee, I mean, what we were doing... Yeah, sort of in a common law way, was now embodied in the law. And I guess I did most of those cases. I mean, I wasn't the only one, but I probably did most of them.
Did congressional staff consult with you and your people when they're looking at this kind of thing, seeing how it was done?
That's a good question, and I don't recall... I think there was a lot of, I didn't testify, but I think there was a lot of testimony and a lot of, I mean, this is where the Home Office would sort of
yes.
take over. And there's competition between the New York and the Home Office, which had its healthy side and its unhealthy side. But I think in this regard, it came out the right way. I mean, they adopted a pretty good, I think just going to today, see, one of the provisions is every broker-dealer first must advertise that they're a member of SIPC, if they are, in fact, a member of SIPC, which virtually everyone is. This only applies to broker-dealers that are registered with the commission. In other words, not intrastate brokers. Under the Act, The SIPC can apply to Congress for $1 billion if it needs over and above the annual fees that they would charge broker-dealers. In today's world, if we had the problems with the broker-dealers, it's nothing. I mean, $1 billion can't cover anything.
Right.
I mean, it would be a tragedy of even Lehman, because Lehman had public customers. People don't realize this, but Lehman had public customers. Bear Stearns had public customers. Goldman Sachs had public customers. Obviously, Merrill Lynch had public customers. SIPC was in no position to do anything about if there were broker dealer failure,
mm-hmm.
and I think one of the reasons in the last couple of years we had all of these, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars is there's no way that the SIPC system could have, let's assume it's not managing all of that, but certainly a proportion of that could handle all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way. But in any event, back then, most of the, and after SIPC took effect, and I was involved in a lot of SIPC cases, relatively small. There was not a lot of loss. Part of that was because And this is the beauty of how our system works. And I really believe this. In the broker-dealer world, it is not the net capital rule that's so important. It's the segregation rule. So that every week a broker-dealer must do a computation on the cash that it has for customers, and obviously where it is, and the securities. So that broker-dealers, if they fail, the customer assets are secure.
Right.
And unless something really goofy happens, but basically they're secure under the rules. And there's mark to the market under the capital rule of every position. You know, I was amused when they were saying, well, let's take the marks off these toxic securities and let the banks determine their value. I mean that's nuts.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the municipal securities business. We're talking about the mid-70s here, I guess, and New York's not doing so well.
Well, there's the two cases, and is the New York case, and the other one, of course, is equity funding,
okay,
the Dirks case. But the New York case started when Bill was region administrator, and we had some very experienced lawyers who were handling it. It was sort of out of the mainstream of the lawyers. I was the associate under Bill. I was the associate in charge of enforcement. So I had all of the enforcement responsibility. And Bill personally was involved with overseeing the investigation. It had its ups and downs in terms of its investigated. You know, obviously, once you get into politics and with politicians.
Give me the thumbnail of what the case was about.
Hi.
Hey, John.
How are you?
Good morning.
What's the matter?
Just let me start running again. Okay.
New York City issued RANs, TANs, and bonds and bills and things. A RAN is a revenue anticipation note. A TAN is a tax anticipation note.
Okay. As you can add, excuse me.
Who? Yeah.
All right, I'll do it right after this.
And, of course, you had your typical, you know, bonds and notes. So there was a range of different securities that New York City would issue and would issue them frequently. In other words, there's a big market for New York City securities. One of the reasons is that they paid a very good interest rate and obviously were rated very well. Does that sound familiar? And in the 70s, New York City was in the decline. It was declining crime, cleanliness, corruption, etc. By 1975 or 6, it reached a large proportion. I mean, it was just way out there. Mm-hmm. And yet, there was sort of, remember Ford, the Daily News?
Yeah, Drop Dead.
Drop Dead New York. Well, that's they were trying to get. All right. So, what was New York doing? New York had its hanky panky accounting. I mean, it's unbelievable kinds of accounting. When we subpoenaed their accounting, they came up with, "Well, what accounting?" I says, "Well, you put out a report. We had some of the report, but it was like they had no accounting system, and they took great pride in having no accounting system because if they had an accounting system, they would be so incredibly broke that they couldn't sell a bond or a note or a TAN or a RAN or anything like that. So, okay. Jimmy Carter gets elected. we're really talking about Democrats running the city. So there may have been a little slack from the Congress and from the administration. Hi, baby girl. Hi, yes. Yes. To try and work things out. Well, it wasn't working out very well. This was Jimmy Carter's first year, 1977. Either I or Bill Moran gets a call from Stanley Sporkin. We're going to have to write a report. And we only have 3 weeks to do it. 3 weeks. Can't be done. We're going to send up 40 people from the home office. And you guys will have to get as many people as you need from your place. We had maybe 40, 50 people. And this was when, let's see, who's the chairman is... you mentioned his name before. He's the one who actually appointed me.
Bill Casey, Brad Cook.
No, after.
Ray Garrett. John Shad. John Shad's before that, or after that.
After that. It was.
Harold.
Harold Williams.
Yeah.
So Harold had committed to have the report in Congress's hands on August 26, 1977.